We have found that this Lactobacillus chansoni that we work on produces extracellular vesicles. So we have characterized the components of these vesicles and have selected a few proteins that we think are important markers. We made antibodies against these proteins and can follow them where they go. So we can see if they just remain on the tissue or if they can generate immune responses either locally or systemically.
Welcome to the Science Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization also known as ISAP. In this podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest, we're delighted to be joined by Graciela Larca from University of Florida, but originally from Argentina, Graciela. Can you tell us what you work on and how it relates to the ISAP interest in probiotics and prebiotics?
Okay. Hi. Thanks for having me today. My interest is mostly on understanding mechanism of actions of probiotics in the host. My lab has spent the last 15 years identifying molecules from these bacteria that have a beneficial effect. Either we start working on animals, but then now we have climbed up the ladder to human trials phase two.
This is an area that really fascinates me, the whole area of mechanism, because I think, you know, while efficacy is obviously more important from the patient or the customer point of view that the probiotic works, knowing how it works, I think, gives the whole science more credibility and allows us then to select better strains with a more likely chance of working and so on. I suppose, how do you begin to unravel mechanisms? Because it may well be that a probiotic that has a beneficial effect has that because it produces hundreds or even maybe thousands of molecules. And I know you didn't say you were trying to get it down to one molecule, but how do you even begin to unravel that problem?
I think in general, we all start by having a phenotype or an observation in an animal model that we're looking for. And then we start trying to understand using in vitro and in vivo technology, what are the specific targets. And it is a very complicated task, as you mean, because it depends where you look, it's what you're going to find. And that's what we've seen through our experiments with cell lines or even with different animal models. The mechanism is not the same. So it's complicated, but it's fascinating from the scientific point of view.
Just even the geography, Graciela, of how you're able to show that effector molecules that are derived from the probiotic that's colonizing the gut, how that ends up having systemic effects. So you've developed like ways to kind of mark where has the molecule gone systemically. Can you talk a little bit about how you use that to get, you know, at least first insights into potential mechanisms?
So what we are doing, actually, that's new research coming out from my lab. We have found that this Lactobacillus chansoni that we work on produces extracellular vesicles. So we have characterized the components of these vesicles and have selected a few proteins that we think are important markers. We made antibodies against these proteins and can follow them where they go. So we can see if they just remain on the tissue or if they can generate immune responses either locally or systemically.
Can you explain to us, Graciela, or at least to our audience, what extracellular vesicles are? How are they produced and how could they potentially mediate the mode of action of a probiotic?
So extracellular vesicles are small protrusions from the membrane of the bacteria, and they can have a very complex cargo. They have components, of course, remnants from the peptidoglycan that is on the cell wall. They have lipids and proteins from the membrane, but they also can engulf components from the cytoplasm like RNA, DNA, metabolite. So in general, it is thought that in some cases they might be specialized, but our view of this is that they mostly represent what the metabolic state of the cell is. However, they have some specific proteins and lipids on the membrane that are also a consequence of the evagination of this. So these vesicles are produced in all kingdoms of life, and they have been very well studied in eukaryotic systems or in our host cells. And bacteria can, gram-negative bacteria like E. coli or Klebsiella or so on, they cannot produce extracellular vesicles too. So it's a fascinating and emerging area of research.
I always think of them, maybe not a good parallel, but almost like lemmates, little packets of information that the cell is sending out into its environment to inform other cells of its state and what's going on within its own cell. Do you think that's what they are? They're communication, a means of communication between cells?
Well, we want to think they are. It's difficult to study or to visualize that when you're talking about two different bacteria, mostly, especially if you look at gram-positive, that you have this very thick cell wall surrounding that. But then when you consider that between a bacteria and the eukaryotic cell, like our host cells in the intestine, it's easier to conceptualize that they can be messengers because eukaryotic cells will just uptake anything you give them. So it depends on the type of cells that you have around is how they're going to enter the cell and how they're going to trigger different pathways in the host.
And one of the pathways you really have kind of helped identify and are targeting has to do with type 1 diabetes patients and the role of inflammation and how a particular probiotic that you've done a lot of amazing studies with influences that. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you're learning about how the Lactobacillus johnsoni strain that you're studying may have potential for helping us understand and reduce the burden of type 1 diabetes?
So this study was studied many years ago where we started working on animals, and we were able to observe that the abundance of this bacteria correlated with decreased autoimmunity in animal models. So since then, we have been doing a lot of studies in vitro and in vivo to understand how the mechanism works in animals and if we can translate that into a human system. So we, in animals, we were able to identify local and systemic effects. For example, you can reduce an oxidative stress response in the gut that translated into a decreased autoimmune response in the pancreas. So having this information, we did a phase one clinical trial in humans in healthy subjects. And we were really surprised to see that it had many, many effects. One of them was that we were able to correlate the IDO pathway, that is the release of decreasing kynurenines in systemic kynurenines and increasing tryptophan that we had observed in animals. We were able to translate that into humans. But we also saw lots of changes in immune markers, remarkably a decrease in percentages of T cells, CD4 positive, that actually mediators of autoimmunity in type 1 patients. So having seen that, we actually moved the trial into phase 2 with patients, and that's what we are performing right now in the clinic.
And for you, Graciela, build a picture for me, please. Someone eats a probiotic and they, obviously, billions of individual cells, and they arrive in the stomach and they have to survive that very significant barrier. And then they get into the small intestine and eventually perhaps make it down to the large intestine. Where do you think the main interactions that you're witnessing in these systemic effects are happening? Do you think they're happening in the small intestine, the large intestine? Where do you think these things are happening?
So we actually studied that in animals, and we were able to see that this bacteria likes to localize in the ileum, in the small intestine. And it's also a niche that where it doesn't have as much competition as in the colon. And then you also have like the mucin layer is thinner. So it's closer in contact with the host. And we think that's how it can have a competitive advantage over other bacteria, but it can also be closer to host cells.
And do you think that's a transient effect, or do you think they actually colonize or take up residence in that niche?
So in our human samples, what we observe is that it doesn't colonize permanently. We know that after 4 weeks, we don't detect that. It's always under our detection limits. But in animals, it was interesting because we were plating them and we were able to see that while the numbers of lactobacillus remain constant, we see a change in the population that is available. So while we're not increasing numbers overall, we are replacing the native Lactobacillus microbiome.
I guess, why aren't the native Lactobacilli performing the same function that you're now replacing with the probiotics?
If you look at the controls, they don't have the same effect in animals, right? So we know that this Lactobacillus is doing something different than the others or not. I think the one of the limitations that we have is that we cannot test 20 Lactobacillus in parallel in either animals or in humans, right? That will be the perfect experiment to do, to really assign this strain does this effect, but this other strain doesn't. So that's almost the ideal experiment that nobody can afford to do.
Yeah, that goes really to a central kind of belief system within ISAP, at least, that, you know, knowing your strain is important. And obviously, if someone demonstrates a beneficial effect with a particular strain, then you can really only attribute that property to that strain and not to other members, even of the same species. Would you agree with that?
I do. I agree with that, especially when we start looking at genomics and we see that the pan genome is so much larger than the core genomes of these species. So yeah, I definitely agree with that statement.
It's interesting too, Graciela, because you do work to try to identify the molecule. Is it the probiotic-derived effector molecule that's causing, is there a specific one that's causing the effect, as opposed to just the colonization itself? And so it kind of requires that you actually know the molecules that are relevant and, you know, that are creating the effect.
I think there is a combination of molecules. I don't think it's just one.
Okay.
We're trying to break down the components. We have done experiments, let's say, just using lipids from the bacteria. We have used some specific proteins and making liposomes where you can, you know, move these proteins into these liposomes. And at least in vitro, you've seen bone marrow-derived cells or even with different cell lines, macrophage cell lines with mutations in all the toll-like receptors and adductor proteins, we can tease out which pathway is being triggered by each component. But probably we think we need all of them to have a beneficial effect in vivo.
And of course, something that we always have to be aware of when administering live bacteria to people with pre-existing conditions or maybe even to healthy people is the possibility of infection or septicemia resulting from the introduced bacterium. Now, thankfully, that's a very rare event, but is it something you had to deal with? I presume you did in your clinical trials. And how did you persuade the regulators, I guess, that you weren't taking any kind of risk with patient health by introducing a live microbe?
Well, our trials are under IND, so we are under FDA regulatory, like a stringent regulatory pathway towards like a drug. It's a biologic by definition. And yes, we had to do a lot of safety and show preclinical data on animals first, like we don't have organ translocations and things like that. At the genomic level, you need to prove that you don't have pathogenicity determinants. And then, of course, you start with a phase one safety trial with healthy subjects where you test that you don't have any adverse event. And then we were able to move into our phase two, where we have children and adults with type 1 diabetes now that they have established diabetes. And the idea is that we don't make it worse. We're hoping to be able to maintain the C-peptide levels if they, whatever they have remaining, we're not going to cure it. But if we can decrease the inflammatory, overall inflammation in the gut, we may be able to make it, give them a better quality of life.
And do you foresee a future perhaps where you won't be administering probiotics, but perhaps these extracellular vesicles purified in some way? So, of course, they can no longer infect, but they would just still carry these bioactive payloads that the patient needs at that point.
Oh, yeah, definitely, because this will be a safer mechanism. So extracellular vesicles are, from the point of view of translating that into the industry, they are difficult to purify in the sense that it's expensive because the cells don't produce as many vesicles naturally. Some approaches are to just use membranes and break them down, but then you don't have the specialized lipids, you don't have specialized proteins or metabolites inside. So our approach is to try to identify the bioactive components within these vesicles to try to make a minimal content vesicle that then can be applicable. And we have done some of those experiments that we are trying to polish right now to be published soon.
I'd like to change course a little bit, Graciela, because one of the things I appreciate about you is how you've developed curricula for graduate and undergraduate courses in probiotics. And the intervention that you're patented and pursuing, you end up are going through the FDA regulatory pathway. And it strikes me that you know a lot about probiotics in terms of developing them as interventions. And I wonder your path, you know, starting off in Argentina and then coming to the United States, you know, becoming an expert in these molecular biological approaches. But then now you seem motivated to actually try to develop an intervention and teach the next generation how to develop interventions that will be under this very stringent regulatory framework. Can you talk a little bit about what you've learned and how you're motivated to try to come up with these important interventions?
Well, you know, as an undergrad, I already started working in Argentina in the Institute for Lactobacilli in Cerela. So, and I think that that environment was great because everybody there works on lactobacillus or interventions on lactic acid bacteria. So the environment was great to really funnel my interest on trying to translate that into the clinic. At the time that I joined the Institute, we had just released the Leche Bio. That was the first one that came out to the public, and I was really motivated. And then moving over the years, I was, you know, San Diego when the genomics area started with Milton Sayer, and then I did some structural biology, but I always had in mind that I want to do an application. I love mechanistic benchwork, but I also like to see that translated into the clinic. And I think for me, sometimes I didn't have the right tools to rely on other people to do it, so I did it myself. And that's how I got into the FDA path, because the IRB told me that I couldn't do that without FDA approval. So I have to figure out how to do it. And now actually we just started an online microbiome master where we're just going to release it next month. And it's actually, we're going to be teaching regulatory aspects of microbiome, how to, what are the paths that are available. So I'm teaching that, and I'm also going to be teaching, I teach some classes on clinical trials. And so it's been, I had to develop all the curricula for my probiotics course, and we even have an official number approved by Florida. So no, it's been very rewarding to be able to do that.
Yeah, the Institute, the LAB Institute in Tucumán is such a fantastic place to get your original training. And I worked in the past with Raul Raja, and people like that were fabulous people down there. So it's a great grounding to work on fundamental biology, genetics of lactic acid bacteria, and then translate that into medicine. I think it's a wonderful path. Too many people, I think, start out in the medical path and, you know, they don't have that basic training in microbiology. But thankfully, you have that. I know that another area of interest for you as well is the individuality of response, I guess, responders versus non-responders in probiotic. Can you say something about your interest in that topic?
Yeah, so one of the outcomes from our initial clinical trial was that we were, we're microbiologists. So of course, even if we do metagenomics, I always want to see the plates and what is there. And we were able to see that different subjects started with very high LAB counts and some have very low. And we also observed that when looking at the metabolites, they were differing on the responses. So we thought, okay, maybe we have a component that is food and intake that will determine if we have responders or not. So we recently investigated that, and we actually find out that there are some, in our populations, at least here in Florida, we have two groups, basically, one that have very high initial levels of LAB that they will not change much over time. But then we have this other population that have low LAB that can increase over time. And those are the ones who seem to be responding better to our treatment. So we look, what were they eating? And we find out that people that have very high LAB counts initially eat a lot of good fats like long-chain fatty acids. And we did a little bit more experiments to find out that lactobacillus can utilize these very long-chain fatty acids that were not described before, like erucic acid.
That's very interesting. Yes.
Yeah. And it always puzzles me that people seem to be a little bit disappointed in probiotic trials when you get non-responders. But my understanding is that's true of virtually any drug, any treatment, is you'll have responders and non-responders. But it always seems to get a higher level of dissatisfaction in the probiotic that, oh, not everyone responds. But it'd be extraordinary if everybody did. But do you think you would be able to get to a point with the populations, at least in Florida, you're dealing with, where you could stratify patients and say, you know, you're going to benefit from this probiotic, but maybe you need a different intervention?
Definitely. And I think that's something that we're actually doing that with our diabetic population right now. We're still doing a dietary intake to be able to see, okay, on the diabetic population, this is the type of food that maybe you should be taking with it to maximize your chances that it will work. From the point of view of like a broader application, I think we should do that. We should do very good trials where we do dietary intake details that we can analyze and understand why some people are responders or not. But, you know, genetics on the population is so variable. So it's not something we can do across the border. We have to really look in detail. Let's say, are we doing a clinical trial for patients in the U.S. where they have a very westernized diet? Are we doing it in Europe with a Mediterranean diet? Are we doing it in Asia with a completely different diet too? So I think the frustration in the public comes from the concept that we try to translate one experiment to the whole population or universally, and I don't think that's possible.
I think it's fascinating too, also how you figured out you're pursuing research on personalizing donor human milk to make it, you know, to achieve better health. So it seems to me you're also kind of trying to understand what causes response and how to improve response, even for a prebiotic, so to speak, the breast milk sugars, but also particularly the microbiome in the milk.
Yeah, that project is really interesting, that we're trying to add a little milk from the moms that can make enough into donor's milk that is pasteurized. So we're trying to see if we expand this population even a little bit, we can make it better for the babies. And in vitro, it seems to partially work because, you know, we have the restriction that some are anaerobes that we cannot expand in the lab. But I think, yeah, it's definitely an approach that we've seen, like, over the last few years, many other labs around the world have tried to. So that's kind of cool and rewarding. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, Graciela, if you could jump 10 years into the future, where do you think your research will be at? Do you think you'll have strains or, you know, a whole, I suppose, arsenal of strains that could be used in different populations, different stratified groups? Do you think these will be administered through food, as drugs, as supplements? How do you see this field developing over the next 10 years?
Well, I think that in the ideal world, we would be able to personalize probiotics for different genetics and dietary intakes, I would say, or cultures. I think from the regulatory point of view, it's complicated because we have a lot of restrictions on the claims that we can do. And I think maybe we should, I know many companies or people try to use multi-strain probiotics, but I think it makes it very complicated to understand mechanism and try to personalize an effect having multi-strain, because usually they try to cover many aspects of inflammation or pro-inflammatory, anti-inflammatory on the same capsule. But sometimes I think we have to be a little bit more conservative and go in one direction or the other. And because it's also your immune cells can also be distracted, I would say.
Graciela, it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you. And thank you so much for sharing your research with us and your time with us. We appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
The International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, also known as ISAP, is a non-profit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. follow along with our activities by searching for ISAP Science on your social media platform of choice or visit www.isapscience.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.